Ernie.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, my name is Ernie LeClaire, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ernie.
My sobriety date is February the 15th, 1973. And looking back on that, the way she, young lady said happy birthday, my God, I've been sober almost that long. Half of that, anyway. My God. And I'm still in awe that I'm sober. I really am. I wake up every day and I'm so grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and sober, you know, that, you know, my life has changed. You know, we're supposed to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I drank a lot, the Navy put me in treatment, and I got better. We can say the Lord's Prayer and we can leave right now if you'd like, but anyhow, that joke didn't come off very well. Anyhow. All right, I am the oldest and the youngest child of a set of middle-aged parents. It means I'm the only child. I had a good upbringing. I didn't have a bad childhood. I was an only child, one thing that I was always curious about. My parents, you know, even when I was in grade school, my parents had gray hair and. And for a long time, I thought I was adopted. All my friends' parents were, you know, in their late 30s, early 40s. And God, when I was in grade school, my parents were in their 50s. And, you know, so I always felt kind of different, you know. Although I wasn't a great student, I didn't excel in school. I had friends. But I always felt different. I felt kind of alone. My parents, I think my dad drank a lot. I couldn't classify my dad as an alcoholic, but alcoholism was very rampant on both sides of my family, on my father's side and on my mother's side. I had uncles that committed themselves to state mental hospitals because of their alcoholism. And I had cousins that killed themselves in single car accidents because of their drinking. So I had an uncle, my favorite uncle, he died of alcoholism, and so it was very rampant in my family, although I didn't feel like I was affected by that in my childhood. I grew up in a small New England town in southern New England, and I wasn't a great student. I was probably a C, B minus average student in high school. I never cared for sports. I wasn't a sports guy. I did play in a high school band, though. I was a lousy saxophone player. I couldn't read music, and I played the stupid saxophone in a high school band. But anyhow, after high school, you know, this was back in the late 50s. Back in those days, they had this thing called the draft, and I knew that. You know, a lot of the guys that weren't going to college, we were going into the military. So I joined the Navy right out of high school. And while I was in high school, though, I worked in a dental laboratory. I started out as an errand boy, and I started working and making false teeth, believe it or not. And I thought I would join the Navy and become a dental technician. Well, back around 1959, there was this little thing that was going on in Lebanon, and the Navy didn't need dental techs as much as they needed hospital corpsmen. So instead of going to dental school, I went to hospital corps school. And I joined the Navy to see the world, and I was from a little town called Nashua, New Hampshire. And my first duty station was Naval Hospital, Chelsea, Massachusetts, exactly 45 miles from my front door. So I wasn't very happy with that, although, you know, I did okay. I worked on a ward that back then it was crazy. We didn't have enough corpsmen, and we were working, you know, double shifts and all that stuff. And Anyhow, the nurse that I worked for the first 3 months that I was there, she was on my case every day. I couldn't do anything right. I couldn't take a temperature. I couldn't take a blood pressure. I couldn't do anything right, you know. And until one night, they finally trusted me to put me on evening shift. So I said, oh my God, thank God I'm getting away from this lady. So I was sitting there one night doing my charting and doing my job, and I hear, back then the nurses used to carry NARC keys on a belt, and I hear this clink, clink, clink coming down the ward, and as she gets closer to the desk, oh my God, it's her. And she starts into me, LeClaire, did you pass your med? What are you doing? And so I finally screwed up enough guts to say, what the hell have I ever done to piss you off? And her comment was, I'm just wondering how long you could take it. So after that, I became one of the guys. Well, I never did any drinking while I was in high school, but, you know, I was brought up a Catholic, and as when you do your confirmation at age 12, you make a promise that you won't touch liquor till you're 21. So I didn't have any, you know, I didn't do a lot of drinking. I didn't do any drinking while I was in my teens or in school. But one night, my lovely nurse invited all of us to her place for a cookout. And I really had never drank. And the last thing I remembered was popping the top on either the second or the third beer, and I blacked out. The next thing I remember, I was in my car being driven back to the hospital with one of the other guys that was at the party. And basically, that's the way I drank for the next 14 years. I was a blackout drinker. I kind of lost track of my religious upbringing, although I did, you know, I did believe in God. But I quit going to church. I quit doing a lot of things. I kind of did the things that I thought sailors would do. You know, they work hard, they drink hard, they play hard. And I tried to live up to that reputation. And one of the reasons I joined the Navy was that they didn't wear a necktie. I still can't stand neckties. I wore them for years when I worked. And so the vision I had in my head of a sailor was a guy in this crackerjack uniform with a good-looking woman on one arm and a fifth of liquor in the other. You know, and that was the idea that I had. And I tried to live up to that. During that time, I finally decided that I wanted to get away from Chelsea, and I wanted to at least see some part of the world. I joined the Navy to see, and so I put in for a school, and I ended up putting a school as far away from Massachusetts as I could. So I put in for a school in Pensacola, Florida, and I got it. So I went down there and became an aviation medicine technician with these big grandiose ideas that I would be flying. I would be one of these flying medics. I would be doing these medevac things, and it was going to be an exciting life. And that happened about 15 years later when I finally did end up flying. But while I was there in Pensacola, I got into a little trouble because of my drinking. We went out to Santa Rosa Island one day in the middle of summer and sitting out there all day in the hot sun drinking beer. And I ended up driving my car back to the base and in a drunken stupor, and ended up parking it and leaving it running across the railroad tracks there on the base. And the base security got a little upset about that, so they came and yanked me out of there after I'd puked all over my car, whatever. Anyhow, I never really got into a lot of trouble. They brought me up to XO's mast, and I got away with it. Anyhow, while I was there, I got promoted. But my next assignment was at Naval Station Hospital, Patuxent River, Maryland, and I spent basically the rest of my four-year enlistment there at Pax River, and I turned 21 there. I turned 21 at Pax, so finally I could drink legally. So the night of my 21st birthday, I went out bar hopping. And of course, I got carded because I didn't look 21. But I couldn't drink much. I drank a couple of draft beers, and I wasn't feeling too well. So I went back to the barracks, and I overslept the next morning. And they came and woke me up and said, "Oh, you're late for quarters, and you're going to get in trouble." Blah blah blah. Well, I wasn't feeling too good. I realized then that I had a case of mononucleosis. You know. I had played tonsil tag with some core wave in a drive-in movie a couple days before. She had just gotten out of the hospital with mono, so I ended up getting mono. And that began our relationship, which was... Anyway, while I was in the hospital, my friends were very kind. They snuck in a couple beers for me while I was in the hospital, as sick as a dog as I was, but they wanted to make sure that I celebrated my 21st birthday. My drinking progressed then for another several years. But in July of 1963, I was supposed to get out of the Navy. I had already taken my discharge physical. I was getting ready to get back to New Hampshire and do whatever I was going to do. Anyhow, on the 28th of May, my mother passed away. And we never owned a home. We lived in apartments. And right away, as soon as my mother died, my father gave up our apartment. So basically, I was going to be homeless. But I did. I went home to bury my mother. And I went to the VFW and had a few beers while I was up there. And they had some postings on the wall of jobs available for veterans. And the only job there was for a hospital corpsman that had no other trade, I wasn't a lab tech or x-ray tech or anything. I was aviation medicine. I was going to fly, you know. But the only job that they had listed was being an orderly at the local VA hospital, making a grand total of $4,000 a year. And back in 1963, even then, that wasn't a lot of money. So I finished my mother's funeral, and I flew back to Pax River. And when I got picked up at the airport by my roommate, and he said, "Ernie," he says, "you're getting promoted. He says, you're going to make E5. I said, "Oh, yeah?" I said, "Well, when's that going to happen?" He says, "Well, about 15 days after you get out." So I pondered that for a while. I figured, well, my mother died. My father gave up our apartment and went and lived with my aunt. If I go home, I'm going to be homeless. I don't want to juggle bedpans at the VA hospital, you know, for that kind of money. So I made a major decision. I went out and got drunk that night. I called my father and told him I wasn't coming home. But I wasn't quite sure that I was going to stay in the Navy for the rest of my life. So I decided to extend for 2 years to make up my 6-year obligation. Well, that creates havoc with the Bureau of Naval Personnel, especially when you're ready to discharge and you decide to stay. Well, I wanted to stay to get promoted. So anyhow, a few days after I made that decision, I got a call from the personnel office, and they said, "Doc, get down here. You got 2 sets of orders, and we want you to choose where you want to go." So I went down, and I talked to the personnel man, and they said, "Well, there's a set of orders here for you to go to Midway Island out in the middle of the Pacific, and there's a set of orders here for you to go to Port Laoti in Morocco." I said, "Well, what's in Midway?" He said, "Goonie birds." I said, "Well, what's in Morocco?" He said, "Women with veils." I says, "I'm going to Morocco." So I decided to go to Morocco. And that year was the first time since the Korean War that the military got a significant pay raise. I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 14 or 15% pay raise. And there I was. I got promoted to E5. I was an E4 over 3, making about $168 a month, and got promoted to E5, got this big pay raise. I got a set of overseas orders. Uh, And I was in hog heaven. I was making up $300-$400 a month. And here I was in a foreign country. The booze was cheap. The women were accommodating. I was there for 9 months, and I decided this is the life for me. So I enlisted for 6 years, re-enlisted for six. And basically, the rest is history. You know, I joined the Navy to do 4 years, and I ended up doing 24. After I made that decision, I got into a little trouble while I was in Morocco on that first tour. My drinking got worse. Of course, I had all this money, plenty of time on my hands, and drinks were cheap, you know. Mixed drink in town was a quarter, you know, beer 15 cents. It was a heaven. Kind of lost my train of thought there for a minute. But anyhow, I decided that I was gonna stay in. And one night we had a Marine detachment there at the base, and they were leaving. They were turning the base over to the Moroccans, and so they invited all the people from the hospital, the doctors, the nurses, the corpsmen. And they had a little club there at a Quonset hut, and they wanted to get rid of their inventory. Their booze and their beer and all that and their food. So I imbibed. I went to that little party, and again I blacked out. And the next thing I know, I awoke climbing a 16-foot chain link fence, getting shot at. I suddenly woke up out of that blackout. I thought that I was going back to the base. I thought I was going through the back gate. But it wasn't. I scaled the fence at the local powerhouse. So they drug me to jail, and they charged me with espionage, resisting arrest. And all I was drunk, you know. And you know, what was this mess? It just happened to be, this was in December of 1963. And President Kennedy had been assassinated just a month before. And I had this bad habit. I used to be able to speak French pretty fluently. And while I was interrogated by the detective that day, I gave my whole spiel in French. And about halfway through him interrogating me, he looked at me and he said, you look a little bit like Oswald. I says, oh God, you know, I'm really in trouble now. I found myself in a paddy wagon, and we were headed out of town. And I didn't know until later that I was headed to prison. I was headed to Rabat, to prison. And over in Morocco, they don't feed you in prison. If you don't have a family, you're in trouble. But anyhow, we were halfway through town, and they got a call on the radio to go back to the jail. When I went back to the jail, there was the base security officer, a couple of interpreters, and there was a gentleman in a suit from the American Embassy in Rabat. And apparently they convinced the cops that I was just drunk. I intended not to hurt, you know, to sabotage their powerhouse. And they let me go. So they drove me back to the base. And I never got in trouble with the Navy. I never got into trouble. Because I was on authorized liberty. This happened on a Friday night. I was on authorized liberty. And Saturday, they brought me back to the base. And I did a self-imposed restriction. I didn't go to town for about 2 months. You know, I didn't know what was waiting for me there. But that didn't stop me from drinking. We had an AC-2C club, and I was there every night getting drunk, you know. And I got back to the base, and it happened that Saturday night. Apparently, the nurses and the doctors were having a Christmas party at the officers' club, and the doctor came back to make rounds of the patients, and he said, "Hey, Frenchie," he says, "I heard you got into a little trouble." I said, "Yeah, you know, I got a little drunk." And anyhow, that didn't stop me from drinking. I finished my tour there in Morocco, and I got assigned to a ship out of Mayport, Florida. And while I was on my way home, I met the gal who became my first hostage. I mean, my first ex-wife. And she was a senior in high school. She was 19 years old. She was graduating late because she had rheumatic fever as a young girl. And I was 25 years old. And she was the love of my life. You know, I met her, and anyhow, it wasn't too long that we got engaged. And I figured, no, it was time for me to get married, so we did. We got married, and that began the nightmare of what went on in my family. I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good father. I cheated on my wife. I did all the things that, you know, that made me feel horrible. You know, I hated what I was doing. Anyhow, that marriage, believe it or not, lasted 9 years. And we had four children as a result of that. I had four boys. Although that didn't stop my drinking. I got assigned to Naval Hospital, Quonset Point, Rhode Island. And while I was there, I was there about 6 months or a year or something like that. And a friend of mine that I used to drink with in Morocco called me. He was a detailer, and he said, it's time for you to rotate, and you know, you're either going back to sea or going to Vietnam. I said, well, I don't care where you send me, you know, it's up to you, you know. I said, but I'm married now, and I have a son, and my wife's pregnant for my second son. And he said, well, I'll see what I can do for you. Well, a couple of days later, I got another set of orders in the mail. I went back to Morocco. I went back to Morocco, and I went back there this time accompanied with a wife and kids, and two more of my children were born while I was there on that tour. And one night while I was stationed there with my wife, we went to town for dinner, and went to a restaurant, had dinner, and then we went out for a few drinks in a local bar. And I walked into one bar, and I was in the bar 2 feet, and in the corner I heard this young lady called, hey, Frenchie, what are you doing back? And I said, I don't think I want to be here. You know, here I was with my wife, and that was probably not a very good thing to do. Anyhow, we left Morocco with four kids. I came back here to the States at the Naval Hospital, went to school, did well in school. While I was at school, I didn't drink. I wanted to prove to the Navy, to my wife, that drinking really wasn't a problem. So I didn't drink heavily. I might have had a couple beers on the weekends, but I didn't drink to the extent that I did until I came to school. As a result of that, I did well in school. I graduated at the top of my class, and so they at that point, when you do that well, the people come down and say, where do you want to go? And there came a list of orders, and there was a go to Naples, Italy. So I said, well, I'll go to Naples. So here I was, you know, I packed my wife and four kids, and off we go to Naples. And that was the beginning of the end for me. And, you know, there I was in a country where booze was, I mean, that was the lay of the land, you drank. And I did my fair share of that for about the first year and a half I was there. Again, my drinking really picked up. And while I was there, I got promoted again. I got promoted to the grade that I always wanted to achieve while I was in the Navy. I wanted to be a chief petty officer. And I got promoted in September of 1972. By that time, my family situation was going downhill fast. I mean, absolutely going downhill. I was drinking again every day. I was a blackout drinker. I was a search and rescue crewman. And I didn't have a telephone, and I lived about 15 miles from the base. And when there was a mission to fly at night, they called the local police that come knock on my door, and I had to go to try to pick up a patient that was injured. And 9 out of 10 times I was drunk most of those nights. Even when I was standing duty at the dispensary at the base, I would drink to get to sleep. That's how bad my drinking had got. I needed to drink to live and to survive. Well, Valentine's Day of 1973, I stopped at the Chiefs Club to have a few beers before I went home. I bought my wife either chocolates or flowers. And I brought them home, and she accused me of being drunk. I said, I'm not drunk. I just had a couple beers, and we got into an argument. And I said, I'll show you what drunk is. And I walked out of the house. I went down to the corner, little bar there, and commenced to get drunk. And I got drunk on grappa. Does anybody know what grappa is? It's an aperitif. Tastes like kerosene. It's horrible. You know, the only regret I have is I didn't get drunk on my drug of choice, which was scotch. But anyhow, I got drunk on that stuff. And the next thing I remember is the next morning, she and the kids are around the bed, and she says, I've had enough of this. I'm going to leave. I'm going to take the kids and go back to the States. And I said, how are you going to do that? You don't have a job, blah, blah, blah. And so I got up and I finished the beer that I had on the nightstand. I went in, took a shower, shaved, and went into work. And I wasn't at work more than 30 minutes, and she showed up, walked right by my desk, right into my boss's office. And she was in there for about a half an hour, and then she walked out and went right back out the door. And my boss called me in the office, and he said, Ernie, he said, do you drink as much as your wife says you do? And I had absolutely no idea what she had told him, none whatsoever. And I said, yes, I do. And that's the first time in my life I ever admitted to another human being that I had a drinking problem. And it felt like the weight of the world went off my shoulders. They said that, well, you know, there's a new treatment program over at the hospital across town, and I want you to go over there. So they did, they admitted me. I went to the Naval Hospital there in Naples, and I was admitted to the ARS. And the first night I was there, you know, I was laying in bed, and I was thinking about, you know, my situation. Here I had just gotten promoted a few months before to what I always wanted to become. I wanted to be a chief. That was my goal in the Navy, was to become a chief. And I was ready to lose everything. I was going to lose my promotion, I was going to lose my career, I was going to lose my family, I was going to lose everything. And I was laying in that bed, and I looked out that window that night, and I said the first honest prayer I think I'd ever said in my life. I said, God, you know, if you're out there, I need help. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I didn't ask to not drink anymore, I just didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. I felt horrible. I felt shame, I felt guilt, you know, what I'd done to my family, and you know, all the things that I'd done. So they admitted me to this treatment program. And there I learned about the disease of alcoholism. And that came easy to me because I worked in medicine my entire Navy career, so I understood the disease. And they introduced me to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. They said that, you know, if you work this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, then there's a good chance that you'll stay sober, you know. And the first AA meeting I went to, there was a guy there that was sober and transferring back to the States, and it was kind of a going away party for him, and everybody was laughing and hugging and drinking coffee and Coke and eating cake, and I'm looking around for the bottle, you know, where's the jug, you know. You know, nobody's this happy, you know, but I wanted what they had. I really wanted what they had. And you people here are extremely fortunate that you've got as many AA groups to attend. We had two AA meetings a week there in Naples. The person who had the longest sobriety in town had 5 years sobriety. He was an Army staff sergeant that was crazier than a loon. And I went to two meetings a week. We had one at the hospital, and we had one at the Naval Support Activity. Saw the same faces every meeting, same five or six or seven guys. The program didn't have a family program back then, so there was no Al-Anon that my wife could go to. One thing I heard that stuck with me and still sticks with me today. He said, you don't have to quit drinking for the rest of your life. You only have to quit drinking for today. I said, heck, I can do that. You know, and they gave me a big book, a 12 and 12, and this brand new book that just came out called Living Sober. And they said, read these, practice these principles, and you'll get better. And I've tried to do that ever since then, you know. I'd like to say that my life got extremely better, that my wife and I reconciled, that everything went hunky-dory. Well, it didn't. I got transferred back to the States after being sober about a year, and that that crazy Army staff sergeant, when they discharged me from the hospital, he said, you little French SOB, says, you'll never stay sober. I said, yeah, watch me, you dog face. You know? So I stayed sober the first year on spite. I was going to show this guy how to stay sober. Well, I celebrated my first AA anniversary there at the hospital meeting, and he's the one that presented the cake and gave me my one-year medallion with tears coming down his face. You know? So, anyhow, after about a year or so, I transferred back here, went back to another school here in Portsmouth, and I put my energy again into doing well in school. You know, for years I thought that my job as a husband and a parent was to provide financially for my family. I wasn't very emotionally involved in my children's upbringing. I really wasn't. Even after I got sober early, I my job was, geez, I'm going to do good in the school. I want to get promoted again. I want to provide for my family. So that's kind of the thought that went through my head. So anyhow, after about 2 years of sobriety, I ended up losing my family. My wife and I separated. We ended up getting divorced. I lost my children. I lost my house. And that was probably the toughest time in early sobriety. Yeah, I was, a year and a half, 2 years sober. And all the stuff I was reading in the big book about family afterwards wasn't coming true in my life. Here I was getting divorced, I was losing everything. And I was devastated, I was devastated I was losing my kids. So there was a Catholic priest that was with me in treatment when I was in Morocco, in Naples. And he was stationed at the alcohol rehab center here in Norfolk. And I went over to see Tony. And I said, Tony, I'm losing my family and blah, blah, blah. I told him my sob story. And he said, Ernie, he said, your wife was here about a week ago. And he said, she told me that on the day that you got married, she knew that I drank. And she said to her maid of honor, if this marriage doesn't work, I'll just divorce him on the day we got married. I never knew that. Anyhow, that was a tough time in my early sobriety. Anyhow, I met the lovely lady I'm married to today. She also came with two children. She had been divorced for about 3 years, so we ended up having a blended family, my four boys and her two girls. And we've been married now for, it'll be 46 years in August. And we have, I think I've lost count. I don't know, we got about 18 grandkids, and we just had our 17th great-grandchild. I offered my boys vasectomies 1 year for Christmas. They didn't take me up on it. I have one son that has four daughters, but my sobriety has been so precious to me. I am grateful every day that I get up that I'm sober and that I'm a member of this fellowship. I've had a wonderful life. I ended up working in the treatment field for over 30 years. I started out as a counselor and I ended up in the business end of it. I've met people all over the country and all over the world. I know sober people all over this country. I've been to AA meetings all over this country, and I've been to AA meetings in Ireland. Tim and I and my sponsor Leo went to Ireland to AA meetings, and I'll guarantee you, AA in Ireland is not the same since we left. If you ever go to Ireland, do not be, don't get too discouraged. You know, when they say the Lord's Prayer, it's our Father, amen. They say the whole Lord's Prayer in one breath. And the F-bomb, they use them all the time. All the time, F-bombs. But anyhow, I managed to have a good career working in the treatment field. I had this grandiose idea when I was fresh out of treatment that, I wanted to work in the treatment arena, and I wanted to help health professionals get sober, doctors, nurses, grandiose idea, right? Well, I ended up working about 13 years at a treatment center in Williamsburg that treats doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and health professionals. That was an extremely rewarding career, life sober has been wonderful. It hasn't been easy. I got the same problems everybody else has. I've had financial problems. I've had relationship problems. I've had health problems. In the last 15 years, I've had some health problems. At one time, I had major depression. I was so depressed, I felt like my one foot was nailed to the floor and I was walking around in circles. I didn't know what to do. I was just absolutely devastated. I had quit smoking, and that put me into a major funk, a major depression. So there was a gentleman, a doctor, doing a conference in Virginia Beach about nicotine addiction. So I went to see him. I went to the conference, and I asked him at a break, I said, I quit smoking 6 months ago, and I want to kill somebody. I can't function. I can't even focus at an AA meeting. I'm trying to use the steps, and nothing's working. He said, well, didn't you know that nicotine is a depressant? I said, and alcohol is. I said, well, I knew alcohol was, but I didn't know about nicotine. He said, yeah. He said, do you know a psychiatrist that would help you with a mild medication, antidepressant? I said, yeah, I work for a recovering psychiatrist. He said, talk to your doctor. So I did. I talked to this doctor, and he put me on a low-dose Prozac, 10 milligrams, I guess. Anyhow, within a matter of about 3 weeks, I'm perked up at an AA meeting. I understand. I can share. I'm feeling better. And so anyhow, I was on that for a few months, and I got titrated off. And to this day, I haven't had the need for, I haven't been in a major depression. But one thing I learned since I've been sober is to make sure that I look out for my health. You know, if I've got a broken bone, Father Martin, God bless him, this recovering alcoholic priest, he says, if I break my leg, don't bring me to an AA meeting, bring me to the emergency room. And when I'm there, if that doctor touches that leg without giving me a shot of morphine, I'm going to kill him. You know? And, man, I've had some problems. I've had some abdominal surgery about several years ago where I didn't think I was going to make it. They operated on me. They took out a piece of my colon, and they thought it was hooked up. And anyhow, about 2 or 3 days after surgery, it leaked. So they had to bring me back into surgery, and I ended up with a colostomy. And while I was in the hospital, I was on a lot of dope. And I was, I was never a person that liked narcotics. I wasn't a big fan of narcotics. I didn't like the way they made me feel. But I needed them, and I got them, and I got well, and I got better. And I've had other issues. I've had hip replacement. I'm a bionic man. I got a titanium hip. I got stents in my carotid artery. I got stents in my leg. I wear glasses. I got hearing aids and false teeth. Now, I am the bionic man. Anyhow, this program, I can't say much too much about it. My home group is the best on the East Coast. And if you don't think your home group is the best, find another one. You know, we have, I've been a member of that group for 26, 27 years, something like that. And you know, every place I ever was, when I was in the Navy, you know, every new command that I went to, I always had an interview with the commanding officer. That was the first thing you did when I checked aboard ship or a new command. And I'd always tell the old man, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I would do anything I could to help my shipmates if you got somebody that's got a problem. And I did that for selfish reasons. Because if I screwed up, the commanding officer would know, you know. And I didn't want to deal with his wrath. I didn't want to put up with that. So, and while I worked in this business, I learned something very early on. You know, somebody told me to look, call AA and get a hold of this pamphlet called, it was a guide to Two Hatters. It was recovering alcoholics that worked in the treatment field. And it was little vignettes of people that started out in DuPont or with FAA or all these big corporations that started employee assistance programs. And the gist of that whole thing was never forget from where you come, you know. Make sure that your recovery program is separate from what you do for a job. And I heard that. I heard that loud and clear. And for that reason, for the 30 some odd years that I worked in the field, I wouldn't sponsor newcomers. Because for me, that was an ethical issue. See, my job was to put patients in treatment. And I didn't want that conflict of, well, how's your insurance, you know? I didn't want that conflict. I didn't sponsor newcomers. I sponsored people. I sponsored guys with double-digit sobriety. I still do. I got about half a dozen people I still sponsor. And but if somebody is new in AA and you don't think that you can stay sober, all you have to do is stay sober for today. You know, I remember I was still in treatment. I was sitting out on a porch with my ex-wife with my third Coke in my hand. And I hate Coke, you know. And we were talking, we were saying, well, you know, this is really neat, you know, being sober, my head's clear, you know, I feel pretty good, and maybe we'll give this a try for 4 or 5 years, and when Michael gets married, I'll have a glass of champagne at his wedding. Michael was only 6 years old. I did go to Michael's wedding, his third, unfortunately, and we didn't drink. Another one of the blessings that I have is that two of those boys of mine, my two youngest sons, are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. One just celebrated 15 years, and one just celebrated 11 years. My second oldest son is out there drinking and drugging himself to death. I've done everything I could to try to help him. I tried to get him in treatment, and he's balked at that. And there's nothing more I can do but pray for him. My oldest son I put into treatment, and he started going to AA, and he caught me at a meeting one night, and he said, Dad, he says, when I go home from meetings, my wife gives me a ration of crap. And she's the one that came to me 2 or 3 times before I put him in treatment to get him some help. So he doesn't go to AA anymore, but I don't think he drinks. I don't think he drinks. Anyhow, this last 49 years of my life have been fantastic. And I got to thinking the other day, I said, my God, I'm working on my 50th. That's half a century. Nobody stays sober that long, you know? My sponsor does, so yeah, my sponsor does. Anyhow, thanks for having me. And that's all I got. Thank you. Thank you.